content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with Brace for Plastic Price Hikes, written by Beth Gardner. The Iran war's effect on fuel supplies is easy to see, not least in the climbing numbers on gas station signs. Less visible is the disruption cascading through another part of the fossil fuel-based economy, plastic production. Before long, prices, not just for the gasoline that goes into cars, but for the parts that make them, along with the cost of toys, furniture, clothing, and more, could start climbing too. The plastics that proliferate through modern life are almost all made from oil and gas derivatives or byproducts. Until the conflict began, many of the chemical ingredients that go into plastics themselves originated in the Middle East. The Strait of Hormuz closure has already created shortages of key ingredients, which could mount into shortfalls of some plastics and plastic products. Even if tensions ease and the strait reopens soon, untangling supply lines would take months, likely until the end of the year, experts say. So far, Asia, whose plastic markets depend heavily on oil and chemicals traveling through the strait, has borne the brunt of the disruption. In China, Taiwan, Thailand, Indonesia, and other industrial powerhouses, many petrochemical producers have declared force majeure, invoking emergency provisions to warn that they might be unable to fulfill contractual commitments. Some have scaled back production as they've run short of crucial ingredients such as naphtha, a crude oil derivative. South Koreans began panic buying trash bags in March, although the run has since eased, and officials in Taiwan asked plastic suppliers to prioritize medical uses to avoid shortages of vital items. India's biggest bottled water seller raised prices by more than 10% because of escalating costs for its bottles and caps. Given Asia's role as a manufacturer of goods exported around the world, its troubles may soon ricochet more widely. Malaysia, for example, makes nearly half of the world's synthetic rubber gloves. One producer announced that it would wind down operations this month because of spiking prices for raw materials, and others are raising prices by as much as 40%. Southeast Asia also makes a lot of tires, and Alexander Tulo, who covers plastic production for Chemical and Engineering News, told me that if they're seeing constrained synthetic rubber, maybe that means the tire production will be affected too. Already the prices that manufacturers pay to buy plastic are spiking everywhere. Dow, for example, hiked its North American polyethylene price by 10 cents a pound in March, then announced a 15-cent increase for April, which it promptly doubled, followed by another 20-cent jump planned for May. This is not normal for how prices are handled in this industry, Ann Keller, a petrochemicals expert at Midstream Energy Group, a Texas-based consultancy, told me. It's essentially, we can get it, so that's what we're going to charge. In China, prices of polyethylene, polypropylene, and polypropylene terephthalate, or PET, the plastic typically used to make drink bottles, have all surged by at least 30%. Albert Lee, a chemical analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence in Hong Kong, told me, polyester, widely used in clothing, carpets, and furniture, is getting more expensive too. Jay Foreman, the CEO of Basic Fun, a Florida-based toy company whose brands include Tonka, Light Bright, and Care Bears, was recently in China meeting with contractors producing his products. Obviously, everybody is incredibly concerned, he told me. Many of his suppliers bought large stocks of plastic when oil prices were low. so they haven't hiked prices yet. But they are signaling to us looming cost increases and supply chain shortages. Such shortages are his primary worry, he said, because toy companies, especially smaller ones like his, that can't match the spending power of bigger rivals, are typically near the back of the line when supplies are tight. We don't have any leverage, so we're at the whim of the market. Soon he'll have to lock in toy prices with retailers for spring of 2027. Last year, when President Trump slapped tariffs on many imports, Basic Fun didn't have time to pass on the new costs. We had to eat them, Foreman said, and he expects to be in the same position if he has to cough up more for toys in the coming months. In other sectors, such as packaging, inventories move faster. Manufacturers and retailers can temporarily absorb the hit, but they'll pass it on as soon as they can, Ed Hirsch, an energy economist at the University of Houston, told me. It's one of these pernicious price increases that'll just inch its way into the consumer's wallet. The impact won't be as big as that from fuel price spikes, Hirsch said, but it's there and it will fuel inflation. Among the biggest beneficiaries so far are companies making plastics in the United States. They are significantly less dependent on the Middle East for the ingredients because they source important ones domestically from fracking. In recent years, petrochemical companies have plowed more than $200 billion into plants, many of them in Texas and Louisiana, that turn fracking byproducts into plastic and other petrochemicals. After China expanded its own plastic production, a global glut pushed down prices, as well as petrochemical companies' profitability. The war abruptly changed that. Dow and other producers with extensive American operations are not paying dramatically inflated prices for their raw materials, Keller said, but plastic markets' new tightness means they can charge their customers more. They're going to make a lot of money if this persists, and they're probably making a lot of money already, Tullo said. The American Chemistry Council, the trade group that represents petrochemical producers, declined to comment. The Plastics Industry Association did not reply to an email requesting an interview, nor did Dow. Even so, Americans remain vulnerable to plastic and product shortages if the conflict continues. Plastics made from ingredients available in the U.S. are most suited for producing single-use items, such as bags, bottles, and disposable goods, Keller said. The more durable plastics, including those used in car parts or some medical equipment, must be made from oil derivatives and are often imported from Asia. That means supply hiccups may kick in sooner rather than later, she said. Many people have internalized the idea that gas prices depend on global events. Now they may be forced to recognize that dependence on plastic makes the world similarly vulnerable. Next, Why Stocks Keep Going Up by James Surowiecki. The military stalemate between the United States and Iran is crippling the flow of oil around the world. Gas prices are soaring. Inflation is back above 3%. Consumer confidence is tanking, and most Americans are pessimistic about the economy. Yet the S&P 500 has risen 29% over the past 12 months and hit an all-time high last week. After a sell-off at the start of the war, stocks are up 13% in 30 days. Despite oil blockades and a threat to a whole civilization, investors have shrugged and kept buying. The stock market looks completely out of touch with reality. But there is a logic at work. Stocks keep going up because corporate profits have continued to soar. If investors have learned to ignore President Trump's chaos, it's not because they're oblivious to reality, but because this chaos has hardly dented corporate profits. Yes, there's a disconnect between the stock market's buoyancy and how ordinary Americans feel about the economy. But the stock market isn't about the price of milk. It's about how corporations are doing. And right now, they are doing quite well. Consider the so-called Magnificent Seven, the major tech companies with some of the most valuable stocks in the world, many of which reported record quarterly earnings last week. Alphabet is now on track to make more than $120 billion in profits this year alone. NVIDIA is on pace to earn more than that, and has nearly doubled its profits from last year. Meta's latest earnings rose 61% year over year. These companies will collectively make more than $500 billion in profit this year. This phenomenon goes beyond tech. Close to 80% of S&P 500 companies that have reported earnings so far have beaten expectations. The average profit margin for S&P companies is now at its highest point in 15 years, continuing a trend that began post-pandemic. There are several possible reasons for this. Inflation and market consolidation have granted companies more pricing power, productivity has been rising, and the AI build-out has fueled huge tech profits. But regardless of why it's happening, future profits are an essential ingredient for stock valuations. So stocks are naturally rising too. This is not to say that today's stock market makes complete sense. 2 weeks ago, a former shoe company, Allbirds, announced that it was pivoting to artificial intelligence, and its stock septupled overnight. Since COVID began, retail investors have also gotten used to buying the dip, treating every sell-off as a clearance sale opportunity, regardless of geopolitical turmoil. But there's plenty of evidence that investors are paying attention to the metrics that matter. Companies that report disappointing sales numbers or miss earnings expectations are being punished by the market. When Nike reported in late March that it expected revenues to drop, the stock fell by more than 15% in a day. Investors are also noting future threats to profitability, selling off stocks as software as service businesses that may soon be gouged by AI. There is some concern that the stock market's price-to-earnings ratio, the amount investors pay for every dollar of corporate earnings, is high, albeit not at the levels we saw during the internet stock bubble. But in general, investors seem to be sensibly accounting for the fact that corporate earnings are not just high, but growing at a sustainably fast clip. The question now is just how sensible that assumption will prove to be. The war's high energy prices are hitting corporate bottom lines and taking about $4 billion a month out of the pockets of American consumers. If this continues into the summer, businesses should prepare for less consumer spending and weaker profits. Investors are also wagering heavily on the AI boom, and the next year or so should reveal whether valuations of various tech companies have been overinflated. Tech companies have been pouring money into building new data centers and AI chips, which could prove savvy if public demand for their products continues to grow, but will be a serious problem if AI fails to be as lucrative as everyone is promising. For most investors, buoyed by years of growth, that is a concern for another day. Although many people, including Trump, understand the stock market as a measure of the country's health, the divide between what investors see and what most people feel is wide and growing. Today's third story, The End of Cigarettes is Coming, by Charles Fane Lehman. For almost two decades, British retailers have told customers that if they were born after the current date 18 years ago, they can't buy cigarettes. Starting next year, that date will freeze. Under a recently passed law, selling cigarettes to anyone born on or after January 1, 2009 will be illegal in perpetuity. As long as the law is in effect, no one who is 17 or younger on New Year's Day of 2027 will ever be allowed to buy tobacco legally. This generational tobacco ban represents a very different approach from the tobacco control policy that most Americans are used to. The U.S. regime looks more like what the drug policy scholar Mark Kleiman called grudging toleration toward cigarettes. Tax, regulate, and scold, but stop short of outright bans. The new British approach will eventually lead to outright prohibition. Prohibition, the word conjures the specter of violence, crime, and policy failure. But the United Kingdom isn't the first jurisdiction to impose a generational ban, and probably won't be the last. The tiny island nation of the Maldives did so in November. New Zealand passed one in 2022, but a new governing coalition took power and repealed the law before it could go into effect. In the United States, 22 towns in Massachusetts, beginning with the Boston suburb of Brookline, have passed a generational ban, a possible precursor to statewide regulation. The spread of such prohibitions raises the counterintuitive possibility that tobacco bans are, in fact, a consequence of grudging toleration, rather than a departure from it. Decades of legal intolerance have steadily eroded the user base and cultural support that justified legality in the first place. Stigmatizing smoking, in other words, seems to have created the basis for an outright ban. That dynamic has implications not just for tobacco, but for many addictive products now dominating a growing share of our economy, including social media and gambling apps. And as addictive designs grow more and more common, prohibition might come back into style. A crackdown on cigarettes has certainly been a long time coming. As late as 1974, at least 40% of Americans were smokers, but that figure declined steadily over the next half century. Today, just 1 in 10 of Americans is a smoker. Policy changes helped create that cultural shift. In 1964, the Surgeon General publicly warned that smoking causes cancer. Advertising bans and mandatory labels soon followed. After that came clean air laws and municipal smoking bans, and then, in the late 1990s, the $200 billion settlement between tobacco companies and the states. Throughout this process, American policymakers did everything short of actually banning cigarettes themselves. Instead of prohibiting them, we took a public health middle ground, allowing people to indulge their vice if they chose to, while heavily discouraging smoking and prescribing who could buy cigarettes and where they could do so. To an extent, this worked, but smoking still kills roughly 500,000 Americans a year, nearly 7 times as many of those who die from a drug overdose. Death is a trailing indicator, and if the decline in smoking population should eventually mean fewer deaths. But even in 2035, one analysis found, more than 160,000 current smokers are projected to die from their habit. Of course, there are plenty of reasons America might not follow the United Kingdom. The UK's socialized healthcare system means that costs of smoking are merely more directly borne by the taxpayer. Americans are more individualistic and suspicious of government than the British. Still unclear is whether the UK policy experiment will work in the sense of reducing smoking's total harm. Some of the people prohibited from buying cigarettes legally will do so illegally, whether with the help of a friend born before 2009 or through black markets. Such markets can and do generate crime. We won't have enough research yet to judge if the costs will be worth the benefits. Still, the results of the UK tobacco ban and similar efforts might offer lessons beyond those related to smoking. America is beset by a variety of addictive products that seem difficult to contain using the delicate instruments of public health. For example, in a landmark ruling, a jury determined that Meta and YouTube must pay a woman $6 million for the damage their products did to her as a child. The plaintiff's case was built on the idea that social media's addictiveness is a defective product design, the same argument made about tobacco decades ago. The Public Health Advocacy Institute, whose president Richard Daynard pioneered the litigation strategy, has recently brought similar suits against sports books and prediction markets. Next, The Attention Span Panic by Franklin Schneider. Last year, I took a drastic step to protect my attention. I cut off my home internet service. I already refused to get a smartphone and have long paid for an app to block internet access on my laptop when I need to be productive. Yet I was still wasting too many late-night hours scrolling X or watching CGI reenactments of plane crashes and VHS rips of old Letterman episodes. Even resisting took an effort that I resented. The internet, I had become convinced, was making me stupid, and I had no one to blame but myself. Attention these days is something that many Americans seem to regard as an inherent virtue, whose purity can try to protect or allow to be despoiled. A diminished attention span is a sign of personal weakness, or even intellectual debasement. On social media, people talk of having German Shepherd attention spans, and liken their condition to brain damage. To reduce one's attention span, so the logic implies, is to reduce one's humanity. But this might be an outdated way of thinking about attention, and one that blames the individual for dispensing something that, more accurately, is being extracted. Some of the most lucrative companies on the planet, after all, are those that harvest attention. Perhaps many people feel bad about their attention span, not because it's too short, but because they sense that they're running themselves ragged by giving away a precious commodity for far less than it's worth. According to neurologists, humans have many types of attention. Serial attention, for instance, might be used to monitor gadgets as they move past on a factory assembly line, whereas the ability to focus on a face while ignoring noise around it is spatial attention. Today's laments about deteriorating focus, though, generally refer to sustained attention, which is one when one hones in on a single item for a long period. And people are faced with so many distractions that their capacity to singularly focus does seem to be undergoing a fundamental change. Tony Rowe, a neuroscience professor at City College of New York City, told me, in 2007, the same year the first iPhone was released, the scholar N. Catherine Hales, then an English professor at UCLA, called this transition shift from deep attention, which is extended focus on, say, a novel, to hyper-attention, a type characterized by switching focus rapidly among different tasks and information streams. Along with this shift came judgment. Hales wrote that hyperattention was regarded as a defective behavior that scarcely qualifies as cognitive mode at all. A great irony of this contemporary insecurity about attention is that, compared with the rest of the animal kingdom, the human attention span is really not that impressive. Although we have many exceptional cognitive abilities, Raymond Klein, the experimental psychologist at Dalhousie University, told me that a house cat staring at a mouse hole can marshal much more impressive attention resources than the average person. But the relatively paltry sustained attention span of some of modern humans is a recent innovation. Hyperattention, especially the sort demanded of humans, comes with astronomically high costs. Concentrating uses up oxygenated glucose in the brain, and whether one is steadily focused on a single thing or rapidly shifting among focal points, both forms of attention draw from the same figurative fuel tank. When the fuel runs out, so does one's capacity to lock in. Like a car that stops and starts every couple of blocks versus one that cruises down a highway, shifting our attention among different things uses up more energy than steadily focusing on one, trying to push through results only in a crash. In the early days of factory work, employees had to stand at assembly lines for hours at a time, focusing on repetitive tasks and moving at a merciless pace. As physically strenuous as the work could be, it was even more punishing mentally. In Behemoth, Joshua B. Freeman's History of the Factory, he writes that workers called the state of fatigued, overtaxed attention Forditis. The wives of Ford workers complained that when they came home in a bad mood and went straight to bed, and that Forditis even made their husbands impotent. Switch out the assembly line for screens and social media, and Forditis seems like a fairly good analogy for today's ailment. Brains that are drained, unable to make room for much else. Still, mere exhaustion doesn't quite account for the panic about attention. When people complain about attention-seeking behavior in others, after all, it's because they feel like something valuable is being taken. And although nobody is forced to watch TikTok, many seem to feel their attention is being stolen from them. When everyone's too tired and atomized from looking at their phone to assess their place in the attention economy, it's easy to result to self-recrimination or to make resolution to reclaim one's focus, to cultivate one's own mindfulness. The desire to escape the attention economy is simply open more pathways for attention capture. The attention economy's subsumption of the conventional economy happens so rapidly that many people may only now be realizing that they're being farmed. As late as 2013, the largest company in the world was the fossil fuel giant ExxonMobil. Just a few years later, it was Alphabet. But these fleecings tend to leave a bad taste in the mouth. Is it any wonder that so many people are so anxious, so restless, so frustrated about attention these days? The queasiness one feels after a fleeting hour of scrolling could be from the sense of soiled virtue, from mental exhaustion, or from a much more American consternation. The awareness, even if only subconscious, of having sold oneself cheap. That last story was edited a bit for time, and we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.